Hello and welcome to Grubbing in the Filth with me, Tom Sharp. Today we're going to look at an animal that challenges us. Limbless, spineless, relatively shapeless. The jellyfish is one of our most ambient animals, almost impervious to anthropomorphism. We can't easily project emotion onto these strange creatures, can't easily sympathise with them. They put me in mind of old music visualisers or the looping background screens on old PlayStation demo discs. These are animals, and they're difficult to make sense of, but we can make sense of them. There's form, after all, within the formlessness. There's behaviour to be found in the amorphous world of the jellyfish. We can learn about them, we can make sense of them, and we can begin, perhaps, even to delve into the jellyfish experience, however philosophically challenging that might be. But to do so, we need help. We're lucky in this episode to be joined by Bailey Steinworth, a jellyfish scientist who is passionate about these animals and who brings these translucent and fluid creatures into sharp focus. Join me then, cautiously, in the ocean, minding out for the stings, as we discover jellyfish with Bailey Steinworth. So today I am joined by Bailey Steinworth, a PhD candidate and biologist from the University of Florida. Bailey, how are you today?
I am fantastic. How are you, Tom?
I'm good. I've recently taken up caffeine again, so oh. I'm kind of shot to bits physically and emotionally with caffeine. And with that in mind, I'm quite excited to get into the sort of what I perceive as the mellow and drifting world of the jellyfish, because we're gonna have a bit of a jellyfish chat today.
I'd say mellow is an accurate assessment.
Perfect. Well, before we kind of dive into the jellyfish world, which is ill-advised, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what has been your personal, your professional relationship with invertebrate animals.
Well, I grew up in Minnesota in the, like, I think to get further from the ocean, you have to go to Siberia. So the invertebrates that I knew as a child were like insects, dragonflies, you know, nymphs, that kind of stuff. And it was really when I got to college that I discovered the world of marine invertebrates. And I knew I liked biology, and the marine invertebrates really just grabbed me. And I got the chance to go to Friday Harbor, which is the University of Washington marine lab out on the West Coast. And that was just a fantastic experience. And I just was really hooked on marine invertebrates, and I love jellyfish. I moved down to Florida to work in a lab as a technician, as a research technician, and I'm still in that same lab now, finishing up my PhD, working on the upside down jellyfish, the genus Cassiopeia, and my species specifically is Cassiopeia zamacana, which is native to these South Florida waters, and I think they're found throughout the Caribbean. We're not entirely sure, you know, how broad their range is, but they are a tropical jellyfish, and I think they seem to have a pretty good life.
There's a wonderful thing when you start talking about even, like, you start mentioning genus names, and you start mentioning the fact we don't know where necessarily all these animals live, that suddenly I realize I get that kind of excitement of quite how little I know about what I'm about to talk about. Which I think is quite a nice thing, because maybe I could tell you what I know about jellyfish, or what I think I know about jellyfish.
Yeah, please do.
So here's what I think a jellyfish is. Uh-huh. A jellyfish is a kind of gelatinous bell-shaped thing with tentacles that hang down underneath it. And it turns up on beaches sometimes. When it's on a beach, it doesn't look very tentacly.
Right.
And they sting people. Beyond that, I haven't got much. I strongly suspect that jellyfish is one of those terms where, like, a bit like, sort of, there's a lot of animals that live in the sea, right, where kind of taxonomy suddenly becomes much more abstract and strange to me, and I strongly suspect the jellyfish fit in that category.
Well, your description of jellyfish, I would say, pretty accurate. There's obviously a lot more detail to them. If you were to ask me to define a jellyfish, I would say it is a particular life stage of a group, a phylum called Cnidaria. And Cnidaria also includes corals and sea anemones. And those do not have a jellyfish life stage. They just live in the other type of form that cnidarians take, which is a polyp. And the commonality, so the jellyfish is the life stage called the medusa. And cnidarians are defined by this medusa and polyp body form. And they're also defined by their stinging cells, which are called cnidocytes. You might also hear them called nematocytes. And basically that body form, whether it's a polyp or a medusa, is basically a sack, basically a bag. They have one opening to the outside world, and then they have a body cavity where everything happens. Digestion, they'll release gametes into that body cavity and then extrude them out through their single body opening. It functions in circulation. They don't have a complex circulatory system. And like I said, corals and sea anemones just live in that polyp form their whole life. There's another group. So within the cnidaria, the medusozoa are the animals that form a medusa life stage. So they'll go through a polyp life stage that looks relatively similar to an anemone. This polyp is usually very tiny. And then they'll go through a process where they produce a medusa, which is the sexually reproducing stage. And there's within medusozoa, there are the true jellyfish, the scyphozoa. So if you're thinking of a jellyfish, a moon jelly, a sea nettle, that's a true jellyfish. There are some others in there that if you saw it, you'd probably say, oh, that's a jellyfish, but they're slightly different taxonomically. There's hydrozoans that make little teeny tiny kind of delicate looking medusa. There's box jellies, which make the irukandji jellyfish, which is the kind that is really deadly in the waters of like the Australia and the Indian Ocean. Sorry, I don't know exactly where they are geographically, so don't quote me on that.
No worries.
Yeah, so there's a variety of medusa species that produce this bell-shaped, sexually reproducing type of animal. The true jellies are the ones that are what we call true jellies. Like, scientists love to be like, here's a word that everybody knows what it means, and now we've decided to make it really specific and tell you you're wrong when you use it to describe other things. So the true jellies are the scyphozoans, and they wash up on beaches and get smushed a lot. So
they do.
Yeah.
So would it be, I didn't realize this. So the medusa is the adult form. That's the form that I've kind of described, the tentacly, right, bell-shaped, yep, ghostly looking thing.
Uh-huh.
And that is to the polyp as butterfly is to caterpillar.
Exactly.
Is that roughly right?
Yep. That's a perfect analogy.
So already we've kind of encountered this oddness within what you're describing, at least in terms of what I know about jellyfish,
mm-hmm,
which is that jellyfish perhaps isn't, obviously within that word jellyfish, jelly makes sense. They're not,
right,
fish. It's quite a casual term, right? So,
right.
But medusa wouldn't be a fair thing to call them because they are an animal of several stages.
Yes. Yeah. So if you see one washed up on the beach, you can say, ah, yes, that's a medusa. But you know, jellyfish is a term that everybody knows what it means, so I definitely use it a lot. But it covers an animal that has several different body forms during its life cycle.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the life cycle of a jellyfish is then?
Sure. So like I said, the medusa is the sexually reproducing form. Usually they have separate sexes. There are some cases where people have found there's a case in my species, Cassiopeia zamacana, where they went to this lagoon and one year they were all separate sexes and one year they went and they were like, wow, all of these animals have ovaries and testes. And then they went back several years later and they're like, whoops, separate sexes again. So, you know, that's a weird thing anyway, but they produce gametes. The eggs get fertilized. Some species, the mother will hold on to the fertilized egg while it develops. It will develop into what's called a planula, which is the larval stage of the jellyfish. It's like almost microscopic. I think it probably varies in size by species, but usually, you know, it's about the size of a grain of salt or sugar. That is a little tiny swimming ball of cells that will swim around, find a nice place where it would like to settle. using chemical cues and sometimes also the physical texture of the surface. It will glue itself to that surface, and then it will develop into a polyp. The polyp is, like I said, basically like a little tiny anemone. It's attached to a surface on one end, and then it has tentacles that extend up into the water and surround its mouth. While we call it a mouth, it's really a multifunctional opening into the body.
Right.
That polyp will grow. It will eat. In my species, Cassiopeia, it has to acquire symbiotic dinoflagellates, which will live inside its cells. And then when it's ready and the environment is right, it will go through a process called strobilation, where the area around the mouth, including the tentacles, will start to turn into a little tiny jellyfish. And then once that has developed enough, that little jellyfish will break off, swim away, and grow up into a medusa. And the cool part is that the polyp that's left behind can regenerate and grow into a polyp and stroblate again. And a lot of species have so that's a form of asexual reproduction, essentially. Right. This polyp produces another individual that is genetically identical to itself. It's kind of like if instead of going through puberty, your head just popped off and grew up into an adult, and the rest of you stayed a child. And some species can reproduce asexually in other ways too, that will produce more polyps. They'll make little buds that swim away, or extend out little just other ways to reproduce more polyps in addition to that.
It's a curious thing. What's really interesting is as you're talking about them, particularly about the adult form, you're using words like, you know, when they reproduce. I mean, are they sexually reproducing then? As adults?
Yes, absolutely. I don't know about in general, but a lot of cnidarian species are cued to reproduce by light. So in Cassiopeia, the timing of their release of gametes is cued by light. And we can collect fertilized zygotes from the females a few hours after sunrise, or in our lab when our lights come on the timer. We don't really know how the sperm are getting to them. I know if you take the females and put them in a tank without any males, they will not release any gametes. But somehow, if you keep a female with the males, and then at the time of day when you know they're about to release gametes, you take her out and put her in her own container, you can collect fertilized zygotes. So somehow the females are collecting sperm, which, I mean, if you see them in the wild, they're often in clusters. They're often very close together. So, you know, and they're very good at collecting plankton from the water to eat. Like I said, their mouth is multifunctional. It's not really a mouth. So somehow they're getting sperm in there too. Kind of a mystery.
Yeah, it sounds. And this thing that kind of hovers in my mind as you're talking about all these things is you're describing what they do, and you're describing you've mentioned digestive system and the production of gametes and things. But to me, thinking like of how I understand them, it is a sort of gelatinous, see-through, floating sack. And it's very hard for me to perceive anything. It doesn't look like there's anything there. So like, as someone who's working with these animals, is that something that you learn to perceive? Or is this what's going on in terms of these organs, or the things within the jellyfish that allow it to function in this way? How do they sort of manifest? You know what I mean?
They don't. I think they don't really have organs. So you're correct in saying that. And the fact that you say they don't look like there's very much there, I think a lot of sea creatures deceive us in their complexity because they become transparent as a strategy or as an adaptation to camouflage in the open ocean. So that transparency in like a moon jelly, that is not just, oh, there's nothing there, just emptiness. That is actually a very specific adaptation to be less visible.
Which has worked on me, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're very good at it. They're hard to spot. And the species I study, like Cassiopeia, they are not swimming in the open ocean. So they're called upside down jellies because they are, you know, at the beginning you said you picture a jelly as a bell with tentacles hanging down. Well, Cassiopeia, like their name implies, actually they're named after a character in, well, a figure in Greek mythology. Cassiopeia was the queen of Ethiopia, and she bragged that she was more beautiful than the daughters of Poseidon. And so he cursed her by putting her in the sky as a constellation, which you probably are familiar with if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. But he put her upside down so she'd look ridiculous and people would make fun of her for the rest of eternity. So Cassiopeia, when they saw this jellyfish that was upside down, I guess the you know, Europeans who named her, named the jelly, named her after that. But anyway, so they're sitting on the sea floor and they are not transparent. And they're pretty fleshy. They're a more tough species of jelly. So there's a fair amount going on there. And when you look at them, you know, they have a lot of appendages. Their mouth is actually divided into a bunch of very tiny mouths. So their whole sort of oral, we call that the oral surface, that is just opposite the bell. There's a lot going on there. So it's not hard to sort of understand them as a pretty complex animal. I think once you spend enough time with any animal, in my experience, you start to appreciate just how complex it is and just how complex its behavior can be. Yeah, even a jellyfish has behavior.
I guess it's true of all, not all, maybe not all, but it's true to a degree of non-mammalian animals and particularly invertebrate animals, that we tend to perceive them as being simple or lesser.
Right.
And kind of as these just things. I mean, jellyfish in particular, and a lot of oceanic animals, we understand them almost like, we kind of imagine that they're more like plants, and even that is unfair because plants are doing things as well. But like, like a jellyfish, I imagine it as, I said drifting earlier, right? But you describe it as a complicated creature that does things, and that, I don't know if agency would be the right word, but that it has a lifestyle almost, and it acts. What is a day like for a jellyfish? What do jellyfish get up to day to day?
Well, I think a lot of what they're doing is eating. They, especially the ones that are in the open ocean drifting, their tentacles are just kind of constantly out there to catch plankton. So those stinging cells, you know, if you've ever been stung by a jellyfish, obviously that's a pretty good defense to prevent something from eating you. Although sea turtles doesn't seem to bother them. They love to eat jellies.
I love it.
So the stinging cells are also how they catch prey. So they're eating, they're drifting. In Cassiopeia, they have a light induced spawning time. You know, I'm guessing that's not uncommon, especially in species that brood their embryos. You know, there's not a whole lot going on. They don't have particularly complex behavior as we consider that to be happening, as we consider behavior. But I've been thinking about the fact that, you know, we sort of like to look at animals as like simple animals who don't do a lot, who don't have a lot of organs, as like, oh, they're more primitive, they're less sophisticated. But that's actually an adaptation in itself. Like, if you're simple, if you don't have organs, if you're not trying to manipulate your environment a lot, like, you can get away with like relatively lower nutritional needs. You know, it's easier to regenerate yourself if you don't have all these mechanical structures for manipulating your environment. Some of this stuff that we perceive as simplicity, which, you know, that's probably a fair word to describe it, simplicity, can actually be a beneficial adaptation rather than just sort of like, oh, well, they didn't evolve as much as we did, because everything has evolved exactly as much as we have. And some of these things that we see as evidence of primitive states are actually adaptation.
It almost feels like we're making a moral judgment on other animals because they haven't achieved the kind of the essentially the things that we can do are the things that we are ascribing value to, right? So like, a lion or a gorilla is more like us than a jellyfish is, because it has mouths and eyes, and it does things that we can perceive as being vaguely similar to ourselves, and therefore it feels more advanced. It does feel a little bit like a value judgment, I guess, on certain animals because they fall short of what we think of as being, like you said, kind of advanced or developed based on our understanding of ourselves rather than on any kind of actual examination of what it means to be alive.
I love that you said a moral judgment, because I was just in preparation for this reminding myself of the concept of Aristotle's ladder of nature, or scala naturae, which is, he had this categorization of all the things in nature, and like at the very bottom was like stuff that was not alive, like minerals, and then there was plants, and then there was like simple animals, and then more complex animals, and then at the top was people. And then in like now I'm not a historian or philosopher, so this is me going outside my, you know, range of expertise here, but in the Middle Ages, you know, philosophers, like Christian philosophers, added to that and put, okay, so, you know, we agree with Aristotle, but then even above people, we've got angels and God. And so,
right, of course.
It's very interesting how we conceive of these, of animals, and put all these weird human judgments on them.
If you're enjoying Grubbing in the Filth, come and wallow with me in the horrendous world of social media. You can follow Grubbing in the Filth on Instagram and Twitter. On Instagram, it's at Grubbing in the Filth, and on Twitter, it's at GITF Podcast. You can also email grubbinginthefilth@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you, whether it's your own perspective, to share a story, a photo, or what have you. Given that jellyfish are not behaving in ways that we kind of can sympathise with, I guess, maybe it's interesting to look at kind of how they experience the world on their own terms, I guess. And you've mentioned that they have some degree of light sensitivity, but I don't see eyes on a jellyfish. So, I mean, what is the...
Well, I love that you said that you don't see eyes, because I have a delightful surprise. Box jellies do have eyes. They have...
Okay.
We're increasingly learning how complex their eyes are. So those box jellies are, I said at the beginning, they're not like true jellies. They're in a different group, class Cubozoa, but okay. They have, so around the edge of their bell, so they have these little structures that combine, a lot of jellies have these that combine, they're often a light sensor and a gravity sensor. And there's just these little, essentially it just looks like a little dot. In box jellies, the light sensor has actually gotten quite complex to the point where we consider it an eye. And I'm not up to date on the research about how complex of an image they can form, but they're actually seeing things. And when they swim, are like steering towards or away from things. Yeah.
Right.
that's pretty amazing to me.
Yeah, it is. And so they have, swimming rather than drifting, they have a degree of agency in terms of what they're up to.
Yes, the way their bell is structured, they can actually steer themselves directionally. Something like a moon jelly, you know, your traditional jellyfish is not really capable of doing that, but box jellies are steering themselves, and with their eyes, they're, you know, picking directions to go. So jellyfish sensory systems, they definitely can sense light. What they use that sense for, we're not sure. I mean, it's a cue for spawning. In some cnidarians, we know that when the planula, the larvae are swimming, they will swim towards light. So they can sense light. Like I said, they have these structures that will sense gravity. So they have an ability to know up from down. They definitely can sense chemicals. You know, they have some degree of chemoreception, which I don't know how much has been studied in jellyfish, but in certain sea anemones, I know they actually adjust the sensitivity of their cnidocytes when they sense the presence of chemicals released by prey in the water. So essentially, like in non-science terms, that means you squirt a little shrimp juice at them, they'll prime their stinging cells to fire.
Right. Gearing up kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And, oh, they can sense, you know, they have a mechanical sensation. So, you know, if you poke them, if you poke the tentacles, they'll pull them away. But yeah, I've been thinking a lot. I've been reading Ed Yong's book, An Immense World, about animal senses, and thinking a lot about this concept of Umwelt. Jakob von Uxkill came up with it, the idea of how an animal, you know, perceives the world, and sort of trying to put ourselves in the place of an animal based on what its senses are. So I think jellyfish are so different than us. It's really hard to imagine what that even is. But, you know, light, chemicals, mechanosensation, and gravity. There is one paper I've seen that suggested that certain coral larvae were more likely to settle in a region that had the sounds of a coral reef, because there are certain sounds of the fish chewing on the corals, or there's one paper where they recorded sound from a coral reef, and then they played it, and the coral planula that were near the sound settled more than the ones that were further away from it. I think we don't fully know all the senses jellyfish have. I'm getting kind of out of my, going kind of wild here, but.
But I like that you are, because it speaks to the fact that basically when we talk about an animal like a jellyfish, we're always going to be limited in terms of what we can understand about them, right? Because we're always going to, with any animal, I guess, we're always going to be making guesses about what it's like to be a jellyfish, because being a jellyfish is not like you mentioned that, you have to tell me the name of that book at the end, because that sounds interesting. But there's a book called Other Minds, which is about kind of the experience of being an animal. When we talk about, you know, this, you know, like the whole question of like, would you like to be a bird? Would you like to be a whale? Would you like to be a dolphin? Whatever. And when we think about ourselves and we try and kind of project ourselves into an animal, what we're often imagining is what it would be like for me, as I understand the world, to have to be in the place where that animal can be. But it's not that, because an animal's interpretation of the world is completely, we don't know what it is. We don't know what it's like to be a whale, and we don't know what it's like to be a bird, because they're not people restricted to that form. They are birds, are whales, they're jellyfish. I'm going to read to you Marianne Moore's poem, Jellyfish. Visible, invisible, a fluctuating charm, an amber-coloured amethyst inhabits it, your arm approaches it, and it opens and it closes. You've meant to catch it, and it shrivels. You abandon your intent, it opens and it closes, and you reach for it, the blue surrounding it grows cloudy and it floats away from you. It's a lovely poem, and I've had to read you the lot, because where exactly would I stop otherwise? It's not a poem in which thoughts are concluded. You can never quite catch hold of a fully formed idea. For me, the poem emphasises the intangibility of these animals. It's a poem full of contradictions and frustration. The jellyfish always is out of reach, both figuratively and literally. And if there is beauty to be found within the jellyfish, and there surely is, then I think some of that beauty lies within the enigmatic nature of the jellyfish and its defiance of our sense of what it is to be an animal. Their forms are pretty and wholly unlike our own. In observing a jellyfish, we note that lovely contradiction which runs through the whole invertebrate world, but which is especially strong here. They are animals, and they do animal things, and they're part of that continuum and spectrum of life to which we too belong. But their lives are different. Not lesser, but different. Their experience of the world is a real thing, but it's inaccessible and unrelatable. Like Moore says in the poem, you reach for it and it floats away from you. I was going to ask you, would you fancy being a jellyfish for the day as a kind of meditative thing? But then, of course, with jellyfish, it's not meditative. It's just what they are. Let's ask you anyway. Would you like to be a jellyfish for the day?
Oh, sure. I was going to say as long as I wasn't eaten by a turtle, but, you know, if I were a jellyfish, I might not care that much. I will say, jellyfish I study, I have sometimes referred to them as the Jimmy Buffett of jellyfish. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Margaritaville.
I am. I have a glancing appreciation of Jimmy Buffett.
They live in the Florida Keys. They hang out in nice, warm, shallow waters. They have, you know, they don't necessarily have to catch their own food. They've got these in-house dinoflagellates that feed them photosynthetic sugars. And they just chill out I'm like, that sounds pretty good to me. You know, I picked a good animal to study because they live in just like a beautiful place. They live in just a lovely area. And so University of Florida, I'm at the Whitney Lab and we're up in North Florida. They don't live this far north. It gets too cold for them in the winters. And we go down to the Keys a couple times a year. So I've gotten a chance to see them in their natural environment, to collect them. And it looks like they're having a pretty good time. Looks like it to me, at least.
Of course. How do they feel about margaritas and sort of cheeseburgers and things?
I don't think that they would enjoy those particular human foods.
That's a step too far.
Yeah, they're more into, well, I'm sure they would enjoy some shrimp if you chopped it up fine enough for them. They certainly like brine shrimp. So
tell me a bit more about the upside down jellyfish then, because this is, again, when we talk about jellyfish, I'm imagining quite, you know, I'm not thinking of, hang on, I know one. Lion's mane, there's jellyfish. Yeah. That's a specific animal, but I'm not thinking of specific animals. So maybe tell me what kind of the upside down jellyfish, beyond the kind of things you described so far, what's special about this specific animal?
Well, one reason that so many of us are studying it is to use it as a model for coral bleaching. If you've heard of coral bleaching, corals have these symbiotic dinoflagellates, which are unicellular algae that live inside their cells. It's a great situation for everybody. The dinoflagellates get protection from being eaten out in the water. The coral gets nutrition from the photosynthesis. But when the corals are stressed, often due to heat, the symbiosis breaks down. So the corals lose the algae. It's called bleaching because the algae are often sort of a golden brown color. And if you look at a coral reef and see that color, that's where they get it. When the algae's gone, the coral turns white and the coral dies. Now, coral are really challenging to keep in a laboratory. And also they often have this calcium skeleton. So it's hard to see what's going on inside the polyps. Cassiopeia, like I said, they're all cnidarians, so they're related. They have the same types of dinoflagellates live inside their cells. And again, like coral, if you stress them in certain ways, this symbiosis will break down and they will bleach. In Cassiopeia, they can still survive if they're bleached. And they're also just much more convenient to keep in the lab. They spawn just about every day. We can get a ton of embryos. Corals are have very, very particular things that cue their spawning. It has to be the right, you know, moon cycle, the right time of year. Some of them only spawn a few times a year. So a model organism is basically when you want to study a phenomenon and the animal you're really interested in is something you can't study. Usually we think of it in terms of wanting to study something in humans, but obviously we're not just going to go willy-nilly and experiment on humans. So a mouse is a model organism. So Cassiopeia is a model organism for coral bleaching. You can stress them out and look at how, what conditions lead them to bleach. You can look at what conditions they'll reuptake the symbionts that they've lost. I'm part of some projects looking at the microbiome and that effect on the symbiosis. Another really cool thing about them that is not, you know, beyond using them as a model for bleaching is that in this jellyfish life cycle I told you about, the polyp goes through this process called strobilation to produce a medusa. In Cassiopeia, the planula larva does not have any symbionts in it. So like in some corals, the mother will pass down symbionts. They'll be in the egg cell. So the planula will have symbionts as soon as it, right away, essentially from the time it's a fertilized egg. In Cassiopeia, they do not have any symbionts in the egg. So they become a planula. They have no symbionts. They become a polyp. they initially have no symbionts and they have to acquire them from the environment. And they do that, their cells in this, we call it the gastrovascular cavity, the cavity for, it functions as a gut and a circulatory system. So that's just that main body cavity. They have to get the symbionts in there, and then the cells will uptake them. And if you keep the polyps away from any symbionts, if you just take them and keep them in a, you know, away from the parents, you can keep them in the polyp form indefinitely because they need to acquire the symbiont in order to strobilate. So it's a pretty interesting thing to me and to a lot of people. This is an animal that needs to acquire needs to establish symbiosis in order to complete its life cycle. So a lot of people are interested in that. It's like a, you know, an outside separate organism.
Yeah, absolutely. It needs, I mean, you wouldn't go as far as to call it like a colonial thing, but like it needs to, exactly like you said, it can't essentially fulfill itself. It can't be the thing it's meant to be until it has the influence of this external influence.
Yeah, I think I would argue with the thing it's meant to be. I mean,
good point. All right, I trust the word.
No, but I get what you're saying. And the thing is, the polyp, it can't reproduce sexually, but it will bud and it will reproduce. It will produce these little swimming, oval-shaped things, and those will become a new polyp. So it can reproduce, and you can get a lot of polyps, and without any symbionts ever happening. And that's another piece of the life cycle that what I'm actually studying is the polyp will make this little swimming bud. My advisor calls them footballs. That's American footballs because they're kind of a long oval shape.
Yeah.
And they are kind of similar to planula larvae in a lot of ways. They swim using cilia and they can settle and become a polyp. But one of these things is produced through sexual reproduction, so starting with a zygote. And one of these things is produced from already differentiated tissues. So I'm studying what genes are involved in patterning those two different ways of reproduction, or you know, once you have those little swimming things, what genes are involved in helping them become a polyp. So there's lots of different facets of their life cycle that I find very interesting. But there's a lot of different things to study. And conveniently, it seems like the other people who study Cassiopeia are like really cool people. So I've gotten to be part of a really cool community.
Oh, good. Now make donations to help offset the running costs of this podcast. If you're enjoying Grubbing the Filth and want to make a donation, like a benevolent Victorian, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/grubbingcast, or you can also write a brief message if you so wish. Any donations are truly appreciated. Thank you. On the sort of marine biology fraternity, or that's a bad word to use, sorority, what would you call it? The community, the marine biology community. Do you find that people who study different organisms incline towards like different types of people?
Oh, that's a loaded question. I don't know.
Do the jellyfish gang have like a rival?
I don't think the jellyfish gang has a rival. I will say, let me see how to put this delicately. So there's a strong debate about which is the first branching animal in the tree of life, sponges or something called a tenophore or a comb jelly. And there's some heated debate about whether it's sponges or tenophores. And I don't think I'm going to wade into that on this podcast. I'm making it maybe a bigger deal than it is, but.
I like the idea of this debate. It's nice. Because in my head, you know, being the fact that you're saying this, like, as an American also, I'm picturing like T-birds and stuff, and
like we're all West Side Story kind of snapping.
Exactly.
Well, actually,
with cigarettes up your sleeves.
Yes, exactly. We all keep cigarettes in our sleeves at all times. Very key. We all have choreographed dances. We do. Officer Krupke has to get in there sometimes. Anyway, I love West Side Story.
When the comb jelly debate becomes too much, do you know what? I've not seen it. I've seen Grease a lot. Never seen West Side Story. Would you recommend it?
I love West Side Story. My mom and I love that movie.
Okay. Are there any jellyfish in West Side Story?
Not that I know of, no.
But in terms of evolution and in terms of taxonomy and how the world was formed and the kind of the wider story of life, inevitably, if you dig deep enough into West Side Story, you would find jellyfish. You know, we have a common ancestor with the jellyfish, and therefore it plays a role to some degree.
Yeah, well, yes, we do share a common ancestor with jellyfish. That's one of the reasons why people study them. You know, because we're always so interested in humans, we want to figure out how humans evolved, so we better compare them to our very, you know, our distant and distant cousins to figure out, you know, how the human body plan evolved.
Do you think, you know, we've talked about this a little bit, but the upside down jellyfish has this particularly interesting life cycle, and it's a life cycle that's pretty unlike our own, and jellyfish have lifestyles that are unlike our own, and alien's not the word to use, but they are quite alien to us in terms of their understanding of the world and their experience of the world and their what it is to be a jellyfish. When you study an animal like that, does it kind of have an effect on how you see the world and what you understand it to be alive and to be an animal?
For me, it does. I think I mentioned this concept of an umwelt, this idea that every animal has. The way an animal perceives the world is like a little bubble that it's living in. You know, jellyfish are perceiving, chemicals and light and mechanical senses. And that defines the world as they see it. And I've started thinking a lot about like the way that, my world is defined by my umwelt, and sort of, it's actually very comforting to me to remember that my experience of reality is just sort of a subset of what exists, and to just sort of, you know, having a bad day, be like, yeah, this is my experience, but the world is just so much bigger than me. I get a little bit woo-woo and out there when I think about it too much, but I find it quite beautiful and comforting to think about how big the world is and how much bigger it is than I am, and how there's all of these beings out there, all these things out there having experiences that I can't even comprehend. And I think that's beautiful. I think that's fantastic.
And the things that you can't judge yourself for not being able to do what they can do. And they are not interested in us, and they're off doing their thing. Right. I think you're absolutely right. I think it is comforting. I think it's the thing I like learning about, but one of the things I like learning about invertebrate animals and animals generally is that fact that it is, whilst humans have a role within, you know, in terms of we always have an effect on these creatures because we tend to be doing things that disrupt them and whatnot. They are heedless of us, right? And they are inhabiting our world, and they are just doing their own thing. And it doesn't bother them about, you know, I don't think a jellyfish is bothered about its legacy. I don't think a jellyfish is bothered about its influence. And I think that's quite a pleasant thing to think about. Yeah. Maybe it does.
I don't think I've quite thought of it in those terms yet. They're not worrying about things. I don't think they're worried.
Probably not. Sea turtles, maybe.
Well, see, I don't think they even, you know, they don't even know. They don't even understand what death is. What a life. What a beautiful way to live.
but on that note, you mentioned earlier the how they have the polyp and the, when it sort of, I don't know what the technical term is, but sort of it buds off into the Medusa, right? And it leaves the polyp behind. And one thing that is kind of talked about around jellyfish is that you have this kind of like little bits of pop science that go around that everyone's heard about. And one of those things is that there is a jellyfish, and that within the jellyfish there is, to a degree, immortality among some of them. When people talk about that, is that the process that's being discussed?
Well, when people talk about the immortal jellyfish, they're usually talking about Turritopsis dornii, which is a species of true jellyfish, so it's a scyphozoan. And what is unique about it is that Medusa form, if it's under stress, can actually go back to being a polyp, which we don't know of any other jellyfish that can do that. So it's like, oh, this is a loaded word. It's like de-aging or no, it's like, you know, going, time is a complicated thing. It's basically reversing part of its life cycle. So not immortal in this, like most of them are probably being eaten or just beat up by the world and dying before they can do this, but they can go back to this.
It's quite a hypothetical and abstract immortality.
Yeah. I mean, I think people who are studying them want to understand this, you know, aging process. I think one thing that is really interesting is that the Medusa generally has less regenerative capacity than the polyp. So a polyp, if you cut it in half, you get two polyps. If you, you know, beat it up pretty bad because you, let's say, mailed it to someone and it got beat up in the mail, they're pretty good at regenerating. The Medusa tends to be not quite as good at that because part of it is it does have some more complex physical structures. So I think it's essentially going back to a life stage that is more capable of regeneration. And, you know, people are interested in studying it in terms of what that means for aging and differentiation of cells. You know, there are people who are studying very specific things, but I think immortality is a big kind of loaded word to put on it.
Whether or not we want to use that word, it's a fascinating process, absolutely. Right? And it sounds like...
And I was thinking about it because you had mentioned, you know, people want to know about immortal jellyfish and why should you pee on a jellyfish sting? And the answer to that one is don't pee on your jellyfish sting. That won't do anything. Yeah. But the immortal jellyfish, I was looking it up and thinking about the fact that it's sort of an example of how this simplicity can actually be a beneficial adaptation. I mean, simplicity in terms of like, you know, the number of cell types you have or how complicated your morphology is or how many organs you have. If you want to be a human and make all kinds of big, messy, complicated things, it's going to be a lot harder for you to regenerate that stuff. It's going to be a lot harder for you to, So essentially it's kind of a benefit they have, I think, because they have such a relatively simple body.
Not something we can aspire to per se, but I mean, simplicity is key. How often, you mentioned the whole peeing on stings thing. I'm interested in two things. The first is, how often when you mention what you do, is that brought up? And then a sub question of that is, how often is the scene in Friends brought up when you mention what you do?
So I've actually never seen Friends, so I don't. The scene in Friends is not brought up particularly often, but the peeing on jelly, the really? Peeing okay. is often brought up. you know, not yeah. like too often, but you know, that's a thing people know about jellyfish, and they want to.
But we are disavowing people of that right now. If people want to learn more about jellyfish and want to learn more about kind of the jellyfish world, is there any kind of resource you would direct people to, or anything that you want any jellyfish adjacent thing you want to steer people towards in terms of what you do and things like that?
Can I recommend another podcast? So Rebecca Helm did an episode of the Ologies podcast, Medusology or Medusaology, about jellyfish. That was a great episode. She's another jellyfish researcher who's super cool.
Well, it's nice that we get to, we're now, I don't know how big, if you go on your kind of podcast service and search for jellyfish, I don't know how big the bloom of jellyfish adjacent podcasts are.
Yeah.
But it's nice to know that now we've made our contribution and that we can now sit within that pantheon, you know.
Absolutely. The pantheon of jellyfish podcasts. Absolutely.
But thank you so much for talking to me about jellyfish today. It's been really, really interesting, and give my best to the jellyfish.
Oh, I absolutely will.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Bailey.
And thank you, Tom.
In this episode, one idea we've latched onto is the idea of trying to understand the experience of an animal. It's a tricky thing, as we've often noted. It's impossible, really. A philosophical exercise and a worthwhile one, but essentially impossible. Jellyfish, lacking the kind of bodies and sensory experiences that make them relatable to us, challenge us when we apply ourselves to that futile little bit of empathy. Maybe we can view them not as a challenge, but as a reminder that animal lives and human lives are distinct. When we try and relate to animals or make them make sense, we slide towards anthropomorphism, which has its dangers. Because a jellyfish is not a soft guy, and a beetle is not a rigid guy, and a deer is not a guy with prongs. They're jellyfish, beetles, and deer. We can study and appreciate and enjoy them just so. And whilst my instinct is often to try and consider what it is to be a jellyfish and go off on imaginative flights of fancy, I should also make time to look at an animal and say, that's strange and different and beautiful, and I will try and enjoy its difference, rather than attempting a kind of weird meeting of minds. So as this episode concludes, I'll think of our floating mates, the jellyfish, and rather than viewing their strangeness as something that I need to overcome, I'll try and simply appreciate it. Here's to you, the soft gang, jellyfish. Grubbing in the Filth was written and produced by me, Tom Sharp, with music by Will Hatton. Well, thanks again to Bailey Steinworth. You can find Grubbing in the Filth on Twitter at GITF Podcast or Instagram at Grubbing in the Filth. You can also email grubbinginthefilth@gmail.com. Thank you.